This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So people living in other areas like Ituri or North Kivu, South Kivu, they feel they are no longer part of this territory called the Congo because the state cannot provide for them in terms of social needs, in terms of security.
That's Hubert Kabasu Babu Katalondi, former governor of Kasai province in the Democratic Republic of Congo, on some of the causes of the conflict in the eastern DRC. Details coming up also. Displaced Sudanese families face hunger. And we'll look at Morocco's Ramadan traditions. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. The M23 armed group has pushed deeper into the Democratic Republic of Congo's mineral-rich eastern region after capturing the key cities of Goma and Bukavu, the capitals of North and South Kivu provinces, respectively, in recent weeks. Recently, the rebels entered Nyabiondo village, about 100 kilometers north of Goma, on the road leading to the strategic town of Walikale in North Kivu. To better understand the conflict going on in the DRC, I talked to Hubert Kabasu Babu Katalondi, former governor of Kasai province in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He says it's presently an analyst of African politics, and he says it all is about the crisis of a constitutional democracy in the country.
I think the key core epicentral problem of the DRC is a problem of deficiency of politicians in terms of complying or implementing, materializing constitutional democracy. We come from far, as you know, the long history, 1960s, secessions, Mobutu takes over, and he started well, you know. He picked up a country that was fragmented, but Mobutu achieved quite a notable, significant reconstruction of the country. Unfortunately, he also drifted into authoritarianism, absolutist authoritarianism, where they called him the King of Zaire. So the DRC, Zaire, then literally collapsed and fragmented and so on, and Kabila takes over. Kabila's era is fundamental in understanding the Congo because through the Sun City Pact, what we call the Sun City Pact, the Inter-Congolese Dialogue, the Congolese came up with a new social contract for the reconstruction of the Congo and achieved, this must be emphasized, the most durable and the most sustained period of pluralist democratization process. New constitutions, elections, and so on and so forth. So currently what we are witnessing, observing rather, it's a crisis of constitutional democracy. And this monopolization of institutions has caused a lot of dysfunctions. So M23, Rwanda, FDL, and other militias are just symptoms of this authoritarian drift witnessed in under this dispensation.
So the M23, like you just said, is one of the more than 200 armed groups operating
exactly.
in the eastern DRC.
Exactly.
How does Mr. Tshisekedi control of a country when uprisings are just springing on a daily basis in the eastern DRC?
It's because what I refer to as I would categorize it as being the degradation of the state, I mean, in terms of its institutions and its functions. So, first of all, national cohesion is destroyed. So people living in other areas like Ituri or North Kivu, South Kivu, they feel they are no longer part of this territory called the Congo because the state cannot provide for them in terms of social needs, in terms of security. But also the other key aspect relates to the mismanagement of the security apparatus, meaning, first of all, intelligence service, the police, and the army. So there's a major corruption in the management of the army and the police and intelligence service to the point where, apart from the social grievances, the army, the police are not capable of sort of neutralizing all these mushrooming militias, to the point where there's another group of militias operating less than 150 kilometers from Kinshasa called the Mobondo. They've been operating for the last 5 years, and the army has been unable to sort of neutralize them. So the state itself, the security apparatus, is mismanaged, also owing to this authoritarian drift, because the presidency tends to manage the funds, even the tactical, even strategic operations of the army and the police.
That's Hubert Kabasu Babu Katalondi, a former governor of Kasai Province in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He spoke with me today here in our VOA studios. Some people sheltering in displacement camps in Sudan's Gadarif state say they need food and medical care. A Chadian refugee who fled from Darfur to Gadarif says life inside the camp is tough for her family. VOA's John Tanza reports from Omdurman.
Kaltum Zakaria Ali, who fled from Chad to Sudan to seek refuge in a displacement camp in Gadarif, is struggling to feed her children. Her one-year-old daughter has not eaten since morning. Besides being displaced by the Sudan conflict, Kaltum has another problem. A doctor at the Sudanese American Physicians Association mobile clinic is treating her for mental problem. She says life in the camp is very difficult for her and her three children.
My condition is difficult. Sometimes I must beg, and those who have money give me 100 Sudanese pounds. Others give me 200 Sudanese pounds, and I am able to provide breakfast for my four children.
Sudanese and foreigners who have fled the fighting between the Sudan Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces say they face challenges in camps for internally displaced persons in Gadarif State. Fitin Awad Ibrahim is a Sudanese mother of four who fled from Khartoum to Gadarif. She says getting food for her children is a daily challenge.
It is 4 months since we arrived here, and since December last year, we received food rations only once. Just imagine a mother with 6 to 7 children who received one food ration, and you have not worked for 3 months. We have malnourished children, and you saw them when you were entering the camp. We need health care for the kids and the elderly who have chronic diseases.
When conflict erupted in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, 2 years ago, families living in the nearby twin cities of Omdurman and Bahri fled to other states across the country seeking safety. Ibrahim says mothers at her camp face multiple challenges, including a lack of food and medical care.
We mothers don't have a lot of things because we don't have jobs so that we can provide for the needs of the children. These are major challenges facing us here.
Some women in the IDP camp fled without their spouses, and others were widowed by the conflict. Ibrahim says she fled from Khartoum to Gadarif with her children, and she has not been in contact with her husband since the war broke out.
My husband is not with me, and I have a sick child who has a problem. He was diagnosed with rheumatism, and his condition worsens, and the disease has reached his heart. He needs to do tests. Even I am sick, and I don't have money for doing a medical checkup because the nonprofits are not helping us.
The Sudanese conflict, which erupted in April 2023, has displaced thousands of families from the capital Khartoum and the twin cities of Bahri and Omdurman. For VOA News, I'm John Tanza, Omdurman, Sudan.
A team from VOA Africa is traveling across several cities in Sudan, including hotspot in Bahri and Omdurman. John Tanza and Omari Kasiko are traversing communities, talking to families affected by the conflict. We'll have more reporting from John Tanza in Omdurman over the coming days. Repeated attacks in Sudan's White Nile state have led to a deadly wave of deadly cholera in the region. Since February 20, the French medical charity Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, says more than 2,700 patients have been admitted to the Ministry of Health Cholera Treatment Center at Kosti Teaching Hospital. Sudan coordinator Marta Cazarola tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the hospital is supported by MSF.
We have been working in cholera in October, and we had some little cases at the beginning of February. But suddenly on the 20th of February, we have an important peak of 600 patients almost arriving at the same time to the cholera treatment center we have. We can link this to a power outage that happened in the Rabak power plant that happened on the 16th of February. Obviously, this attack destroyed part of the electrical system, so the water was not pumped, and the community had to change the way they were fetching water. And that led, after 4 days on February the 20th, to this important peak of cholera cases.
I understand that it's so bad there at the Costi Teaching Hospital that the MSF people and the other health workers there are dealing with patients just lying on the floor.
Yes, the cholera treatment center that we were collaborating with the Minister of Health in the Costi Teaching Hospital had about 30-40 beds for cholera. That was the capacity was higher than the average patients we were receiving, but suddenly 600 patients. Imagine it was not possible to attend them properly as we would have wished, both Doctor Without Borders and the Minister of Health staff. So yes, we had to put some people lying on the floor, protected with plastic seating so that they could be attended on the floor. It was a small city suddenly in one morning.
It was an attack on the Rabak power plant. Was this a deliberate attack on infrastructure by the RSF in that area?
The information that we have reportedly was the Rapid Support Forces, and it's not the first time, and it's not the only place where this is happening. For MSF, we want to really the worrying parties to protect the civilian and the critical infrastructures. This country has already a very weak health system because of the war, and these attacks on these electrical infrastructures and others is not really, really helping. So this protecting the civilian structures is quite important for the population.
This seems to be a particularly bad cholera outbreak. Have there been deaths linked to it in White Nile?
Yes, since the 20th up to just today, we have accumulated about 90 deaths. We are talking about an accumulated number of almost 2,700 patients is a lot. Not all of them died directly in the cholera treatment center. Some of them, they were arriving at the entrance when arriving. We know that also possibly there has been a bigger impact in the community of cases that we are not aware because they didn't reach the cholera treatment center. But what we have recorded in the hospital together with the Minister of Health is 90.
What is MSF doing? So what are you trying to do to control the spread of cholera in that area?
Well, MSF, since last year in October, we have been collaborating with the Minister of Health in several places, not only in Costi, but we have been working in other states all along Sudan, in Kasala, in Gedaref, in River Nile, in Al Jazeera, and in Khartoum. And, of course, in White Nile. In White Nile itself, by October and November, we were working not only in Costi, but in Rabak, in Tendenti, in Al-Kashafa, collaborating to help to reduce the impact of the cholera outbreak. All this has been done in collaboration with the Minister of Health. We have been helping us in improving the cholera treatment center, putting supplies available, not only medical, but also logistical and water and sanitation materials, also activities in the community health promotion.
That is MSF's emergency coordinator to Sudan, Marta Cazarola. She was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from Port Sudan. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1-202-258-3076. We'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. Kenya's government has signed a cooperation pact with the main opposition party that will see both political sides involved in a critical government policy. The Associated Press says the move has been criticized as an attempt to silence the opposition. President William Ruto and the main opposition leader, Raila Odinga, held a signing ceremony on Friday. It is the fourth time Odinga, a five-time election loser, has signed a pact with a sitting president. The two leaders said the agreement was not aimed at distributing government positions among the two parties, but instead it provided a framework for consultations on issues that affect Kenyans. But some critics say the deal effectively means there would be no opposition party in parliament. Ramadan in Morocco, like elsewhere in the world, is a month of fasting, prayer, charitable giving, and reflection. In Morocco, the holy month involves some special traditions and some common rituals shared with other Muslims around the world. Mohamed El Wafi is a Moroccan-American and a former Moroccan diplomat in Washington. He talked with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shenawi about Ramadan in his native country.
Obviously, there is some common traditions, rituals, prayers in the mosques, and uniting families around the table for the breakfast time. But it differs from a region to another. The south of Morocco have different traditions due to weather, due to heritage, differs from the north. Normally, Al Harira, it's a common dish presented in the Moroccan table during the month of Ramadan. All Moroccans must have Harira, which is well known among many populations around the world. They know Harira. It's a complete meal that includes meats, chicken, all the ingredients, including vegetables. And it's done in a manner that leaves you completely full after eating a bowl of Harira together with the dates and some sweets, and combined between sweets and sour at the same time. Also, during the month of Ramadan, Moroccans tend to go visit families after the breakfast. Husband and wife take one day to her father's and the second day to his father's, and spend the whole night with them, pray together, maybe go to the mosque, and then chat, speak, watch their favorite programs on TV, and then go back for the suhoor, which is the last meal eaten during the night of Ramadan before the sun rise. Also, there is a tradition of paying a lot of attention to kids, especially in their first day of fasting, and preparing future generation for this kind of spirituality and belief. So, Morocco differs in dishes, food, spices. The traditions in the streets are totally different from the rest of the Arab and Muslim world. And all that, Mr. Mohammed, is due to the non-existence of the Ottoman Empire in Morocco. Morocco kept its own traditions because it was the only Arab country that was not invaded by the Ottoman Empire. And that had left Morocco with its own traditions, Andalusian, a mixture of Andalusian, Berber, Arab, a unique mixture of traditions that allow this country to be distinguished all among all the other Arab and Muslim states.
As a Moroccan American, what do you miss living Ramadan in America?
Obviously, family. Missing the family, missing the gathering, missing share with them that beautiful moment of iftar and go to the mosque with dad and take mom for a walk after breakfast. A Ramadan without family, you lack a very, very crucial and important element of this holy month, which is having your family around you in during the breakfast table.
Do Moroccan Americans gather and breakfast together in this area?
I would say yes, but with an exception that Moroccan American population in the United States tend to integrate with other Muslim communities. Mostly they do share their breakfast, especially with Egyptians and Jordanians, and they have specific nationalities like Egyptians, for example. In many ways, I've seen Moroccans married to Egyptian, female married to Moroccans married to cross marriage, have created this kind of cross-cultural too. But I would say Moroccans are not isolated in the sense of being just Moroccans. Rather, they have friends, like I said, Egyptian, Jordanians, and some Gulf countries too.
That was Mohamed El Wafi, a Moroccan-American and a former Moroccan diplomat in Washington, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El Shenawi. A Trump administration hostage negotiator called his recent meetings with representatives of U.S.-designated terror group Hamas helpful. Discussions focused on the release of an American-Israeli hostage held by Hamas. This, as Israel says, it plans to deploy a delegation this week to discuss ceasefire talks. VOA's Arash Arbasadi has the story.
Thousands of protesters in Israel gathered outside the Defense Ministry in Tel Aviv this weekend. They demanded the Israeli government broker a hostage release deal with Hamas. In Washington last week, U.S. President Donald Trump confirmed his administration had, for the first time, held direct talks with Hamas, a departure from the long-standing U.S. policy not to negotiate with terrorists. Trump, as provided by Reuters.
We are having discussions with Hamas. We are helping Israel in those discussions because we're talking about Israeli hostages. And we're not doing anything in terms of Hamas. We're not giving cash. In fact, I got 59 hostages out and we gave nothing. In 59, we gave nothing.
Sunday morning, supporters and relatives of hostages awoke in tents outside the Israel Defense Ministry. Their message was clear. No new conflicts with Hamas, just secure a hostage release deal. Ayala Metzger, demonstrator and daughter-in-law of dead hostage Yoram Metzger, speaking with Reuters.
There are dozens of people that came with us to say the government don't get inside Gaza again. Stop this war and bring all the hostages back home.
In recent days, a Trump administration negotiator met with Hamas to discuss a hostage release deal, calling the meeting very helpful. U.S. hostage envoy Adam Bowler speaking Sunday on CNN's State of the Union, as provided by the social media platform X.
I think something could come together within weeks. I will say that I believe there is enough there to make a deal between what Hamas wants and what they've accepted, and what Israel wants, and it's accepted. And I think I think there is a deal where they can get all of the prisoners out, not just the Americans.
In the meantime, for Palestinians in Gaza's Khan Yunis, shortages of basic needs continue. Israel imposed a total blockade on all goods entering the enclave, including food, fuel, and medicine, until Hamas frees the remaining 59 hostages still held in Gaza. People here say they wait for hours to get bread as there's no longer electricity or firewood for cooking. Israel says it plans to send a delegation to Qatar on Monday to advance negotiations with Egyptian and Qatari mediators. Arash Arbasadi, VOA News.
The Vatican says that Pope Francis spent a quiet night in the hospital a day after the 88-year-old pontiff thanked doctors for his care during the more than 3 weeks that he has been hospitalized. The French news agency AFP reports that the leader of the world's nearly 1.4 billion Catholics has shown slight signs of improvement in recent days, appearing to respond well to his treatment for pneumonia. Another medical bulletin is expected later on this evening. The Pope has not been seen in person since he was admitted on February 14th to Rome's Gemelli Hospital, where he is being cared for in a special papal suite. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Jumbe Hamza, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.